cobblestones. They come in all shapes and sizes, all hues and textures. Some are round, gray, and dull. Others are sharp, smooth, and brilliant. This one may be pink and orange, and just a little bit monstrous. When Fran Brill left college, it was as part of a new show set to premiere on Broadway. Luckily for her, that show proved a flop and led her to a want ad written by Jim Henson. 5 Emmys and 42 years later, she's leaving Sesame Street. But first, she joins us to wander down the cobblestone path and tell the tale of the evolution of an iconic children's TV show and her early days with Jim Henson. Strolling along beside her, we may just encounter Dave Goals, Jim Lewis, Bonnie Erickson, Raleigh Cruson, Craig Shemin, and many others who live along this cobblestone path. Welcome to Cobblestones. Today we walk down the path eclectic to a street where it's always sunny.
Excuse me, did you say street?
I thought this was cobblestones. Why aren't we going down a path?
A street full of old familiar friends.
Wait, are you telling me that we've completely left the path and this is the street?
Da da da. Huh, it doesn't really look like a gritty crime show. Maybe he's going to do some nifty market analysis.
No, it is cobblestones. Today we're visiting with 5-time Emmy Award winner Fran Brill on Sesame Street.
But is it a path or a street? You're supposed to know these things.
Wait a minute. It was rainy.
It was?
Yes, on the day he conducted the interviews, it was raining.
But he just said it was sunny.
You guys don't understand.
Isn't it important for a reporter to tell the truth?
He isn't very credible, is he?
Guys, I was just alluding to the Sesame Street theme song. Maybe Raleigh Cruson can explain it better. Raleigh was the first intern hired by the Jim Henson Company, and for more than 37 years, she's been creating and fixing up all kinds of critters, including some of the most beloved Sesame Street characters, such as Elmo.
Elmo! I love Elmo!
I want his agent!
Well, Raleigh didn't make the first Elmo, but she's been building him for 18 years.
18 years? Why, Elmo doesn't look a day over 5. I wonder if he's had a little nip-tuck. A little, you know, snip-snip, glue-glue.
Raleigh, could you help me out?
Hi, Raleigh.
Should listeners feel deceived and betrayed if it's raining when we visit Sesame Street?
No, it's sunny in here. Look how bright and shiny it is in here, and all the characters are bright. You know, it's sunny in here. It may not be sunny outside, but it's always sunny at Sesame Street.
Oh, why didn't you say so?
Well, I guess it could have been sunny indoors. Do they have a sun lamp?
Fran Brill was the first female performer hired by Jim Henson on Sesame Street and has voiced innumerable characters, from the Countess and Little Bird to Zoe. Today on Cobblestone, she's going to recount her adventures on Sesame Street and with Jim Henson. We'll also hear from puppet builder Bonnie Erickson and scriptwriter Jim Lewis. And if the sun does come out, we'll even chat with Sesame Street Zoe. I'm Andrew Hiller. When you first got to Sesame Street, all the performers were over 6 foot tall and male. In fact, Raleigh Cruson described the original Henson Gang as an old boys club. How did you break that up?
Well, I'm not sure I totally did, to be honest. I sort of tried to walk that line of, you know, not being offended, you know, by anything they said, but also not really trying to be a male while I was there. You know, I was myself, and I am kind of a spunky person, and I'd been in the theater my whole life, so it wasn't like anything was going to bother me that was said or whatever. And I think I was reasonably fun to be around. So, you know, I don't know. I just sort of fell in, and I never really thought about it very much. I never really thought, oh my gosh, I'm the only girl here. It wasn't only until later when it was pointed out to me that I realized, oh yeah, guess I was.
And how did you get that gig? How did you land a role on Sesame Street?
Well, the brief version of that is that I wanted to be an actress ever since I was a little girl. And I did a lot of theater when I was in high school, and then I went to Boston University Fine Arts School, and I majored in drama. And then I joined a regional theater in Atlanta, and we did a show, an original musical that unbelievably went to Broadway. So there I was, you know, having just graduated from college in a Broadway show. But unfortunately, the show opened and closed rather rapidly, and then I was an unemployed actress like everyone else.
So you were like an overnight success and an instant heartbreak all at the same time.
I guess so. But, you know, it's sort of what you just go through as a performer. You roll with the punches, and, you know, what seems very important at the time you realize isn't so important in terms of, you know, bad things happening to you or not getting a job. But this turned out to be a wonderful job because Jim Henson had an extraordinary effect on the rest of my life. For one thing, as a human being and a boss, you could not have wished to be around anyone more wonderful. He never judged me or really anyone. You know, he didn't expect me to be a brilliant manipulator off the bat. He knew this was a learning curve. And he and Frank were extremely skilled. And I basically learned from them.
And what did you learn? What was your first role on Sesame Street?
I began, like other puppeteers do begin, the newbies, as we call them. I was a right hand for the live hand puppets. A live hand puppet being a character like Ernie or Cookie Monster, where it takes two people. The principal puppeteer puts his right hand into the puppet's head and his left hand into the puppet's left hand or sleeve. And then another secondary puppeteer, that would be me, would come around and put their right hand into the puppet's right hand. And then you'd have to sort of ascertain what the principal puppeteer wanted to do with the puppet, or you'd talk about it. But a live hand puppet can handle props and clap its hands or grab another puppet. And that's how new puppeteers begin. And you sort of learn what life is like on a television stage. And you just sort of learn the ropes that way. And then once in a while, they might throw you a small character.
And the list of characters they handed her grew from birds to vampires and other monsters without a precise definition. Craig Shemin, a longtime Muppet writer and the current president of the Jim Henson Legacy, says that Fran was an important member of that company. But more importantly, that each character fit like a stone on a cobblestone path to form a whole, without which the show may have tripped up.
I think that Fran, being the gifted actress that she is, once she was added to the mix and you had real female characters that didn't just sound like high voice guys, it brought an enormous amount of more of this real reality to the characters, especially in Prairie Dawn. Because she has so many dimensions to her. She's not just the squeaky, sweet little girl.
I can do all by myself. I can take my...
That a lot of shows have. She has a lot of energy. She has a lot of passion. She gets agitated. She gets aggravated. She's really a real person. One of the things about the Muppets, you know, and this is my personal theory about writing for the Muppets, and it goes for any of the character worlds, and it goes for any ensemble character group in writing, that the reason the Muppets work is that each character represents a different part of a real person. You know, if you look at the classic Muppets, Miss Piggy is vain. She's egotistical. Kermit is more level. Fozzie is insecure. All of these different traits, when you blend all this whole group of together, it's one human being. And I think that bringing that aspect to children's television really works. And you look at it in Sesame Street, it's the same sort of thing. You have Ernie and Bert. You have Ernie the playful, Bert very uptight. Oscar is very grouchy. Big Bird sweet-natured. All of the Sesame Street group of characters have that aspect to them. When you put them all together, you get one real person.
Do all the characters in a show blend to form one person? Fran Brill, sitting in the shade of our cobblestone path, says that not all of her characters were large, like Big Bird. In fact, her first one was small.
Jim gave me a little character called Little Bird, who was a buddy of Big Bird. And Little Bird sounded like that. And we never knew what sex Little Bird was, but I think I always thought Little Bird was a boy. And so that was my first real little character on Sesame Street. And not long after that, I was handed a little pink puppet, and they wanted that puppet to be the quintessential little girl, because up till now, all the female characters on Sesame Street were done by the guys in falsetto. And that was really funny, but I think they felt that it was time for a more accurate representation of a female on Sesame Street. And that's partly why I got hired, I'm sure, is that they had no females. And I just tripped and fell into this job, to be honest. But more importantly, he was just so kind. You know, he never yelled at you or said, you know, or criticized you, and he certainly would never do it in front of anybody else. And he was raised that way. It wouldn't occur to him to yell at you or go, oh, no, you ruined a take. Not that that happens really on Sesame Street anyway, because everyone has sort of replicated Jim's personality as best as they can. But he was such a decent, wonderful human being who treated everybody the same, whether it was the guy who, you know, collected the garbage at the end of the day or the head of a network. He just, that's the way he was raised. And so I think I came out a better human being as a result of rubbing shoulders with him all those years. He just, you sort of imitate the boss, I think, in any company. And since he was such a wonderful person and was kind and generous and supportive, you know, he was a mentor. And then the rest of us became mentors to other new puppeteers. And we're all like little seedlings of Jim Henson. We sort of try to pass on what we were taught, both as human beings and as professionals.
You know, the more I hear about Jim Henson, the more I get the feeling he wasn't really looking for a particular kind of skill set as much as a kind of person.
I think everyone he hired, even in the office, you know, forget about the performers, was somebody that Jim felt he had a kinship with, either creatively, you know, or just felt that they were the kind of person that he was. And I think that's very accurate. And if you weren't like that, you didn't last long. I would say, you know, if you had an abrasive personality or had an ego or something like that, you just didn't last long, because the one nice thing about the Muppets is that it's always been a collaboration. And Jim or Frank would have no problem saying after a take, well, what did you think? You know, even to me or whoever lowly person at the time, we would take criticism, but it wasn't criticism. It was always meant as helping you, like, hey, you know what? If you turn your body this way, you'll be able to see the monitor better. We would help each other and listen to each other. And of course, you have to remember that at this time, nobody thought that Sesame Street was going to become the juggernaut that it became. This was just, you know, a kid's show. It was an experimental kid's show. I'm not sure that anybody thought it would last past 13 episodes. So I don't think there was an enormous amount of pressure that anybody felt. Mostly we were inventing the wheel, you know, and seeing what worked and how to put on this show, you know, trying to find the best writers they could find and the best directors. And there was a mindset, which is, we're not going to talk down to the children. Basically, we're doing this to amuse ourselves and to educate. And that's why things like Monsterpiece Theater, for instance, was created. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. I remember it very well.
Okay. You know, that was just fun, because Masterpiece Theater was this enormous hit at the time. on the public television stations. So we parodied it, as we parodied many, many other shows. And the writers were hired not because they wrote children's books or songs previously, but because they had worked with either somebody in that group of people that were creating the show, like Jim Henson had worked with Joe Raposa at one point, and Joe Raposa knew Jeff Moss, and you know, that's how this team really came together. One person knew another person and recommended them. But everyone was of the same mindset, which is we're not going to talk down to children. And the writers were really comedy, blackout sketch writers. They were not, you know, previously children's theater or children's television writers. And that's why the show had that little edge to it.
Oh, hello. This Alistair Cookie here for Monsterpiece Theater.
Speaking of writers, let's step off our cobblestone path chat with Fran Brill to meet one. Waiting for us in the shade in Burbank, California, is Jim Lewis. He was born in 1955, the same year as Kermit the Frog, and has been writing for the Muppets for over 25 years.
I couldn't even imagine working for them. I knew I wanted to be funny for money, and I couldn't figure out how.
He grew up watching the Henson characters in New Jersey, an overweight child who used humor as a defense mechanism to shield himself from bullies. By the time he did figure out how to hook up with the Jim Henson Company, The Muppet Show had finished its run, and Henson was working on the movie The Dark Crystal. Lewis's first opportunity came with The Muppet Magazine.
The conceit of the magazine was the Muppets were writing the magazine. Kermit was the frog in chief. Piggy did, you know, interviews, celebrity interviews. It was kind of a people magazine, as if the Muppets hosted it. And so I got to live inside the heads of these characters, interview from their point of view, and see how they interacted in the real world.
His familiarity writing as the characters landed him an opportunity to write for video, TV, and film.
Eventually, they started to do some video that was in the early days of home video, and they wanted somebody to write a Fozzie Bear How to Be a Comic video, and Jerry Jewel was busy on something else, and they gave me a shot.
Ah, are you ready, comedy partner? Waka waka.
Lewis says there's a difference writing for the page and the stage.
On the page, you know, more words better. Or it tends to be. You can, you know, make it rich, and there are levels of things you can't show or hear, but things you have to say. And I had to learn to trim that back in writing for the characters and let them, you know, pull it off.
One advantage Lewis had that most writers don't is he was able to meet with and chat with his fictional characters.
On the very first video, the video about, hey, you're as funny as Fozzie Bear, which was it must be a collector's, up there with the Star Wars Christmas show as collector's items go. But it was the first thing where I was writing for the Muppets, and I was in a studio with Jim Henson and Frank Oz, and they called me over and they said, do you mind if we think if we cut this line and go from here to here, this would work? And I had this out-of-body experience where I said, Jim Henson and Frank Oz are asking my opinion. I had never written a script for them before, and they cared enough to, like, not just say, This is garbage, throw it away, oh, we're going to change it, which was their absolute right. That gave me not only a confidence, but just a sense of belonging that was unbelievable.
And sometimes knowing you made it can come from a single word.
There was a moment and the scene was just not ending right. And I finally, and it was a Miss Piggy, I think it was Rumpelstiltskin or one of the stories, it was retelling Famous Fairy Tales. And I went over to Frank and I said, and what if Piggy just does a fist pump and says, yes? And Frank said, sure, I'll try it. He did it, and it killed. And I still get little goosebumps because he came over to me later and says, nice one. And that was when I felt like, well, maybe I can do this, so. Yes, and it was, you know, like the brilliant line, yes, and the fist pump. And, of course, it was all Frank pulling it off. But, you know, that was a great moment for me.
You did it. You You shall be my queen. Yes!
Then again, sometimes even one word is too much. Every screenwriter learns the value of silence.
That really is a testimony to the performers, because people assume Piggy can blink her eyes or that Kermit can, you know, blink his eye. They don't have that. It's the subtlety of the performance that they're able to create an emotion just by a slight movement of their hand and how they manipulate the character, how they perform the character. And when you watch that for a while, you say, well, why should I write all this dialogue when you may give a direction in the script? Kermit turns to Piggy and does face scrunch. And then Jim, and now Steve, would take that and turn it into magic.
In fact, Kermit taught Lewis a valuable lesson about the power of silence one day on Fox's Hannity and Colmes.
One of my favorite Kermit appearances was on, of all places, Fox News, on Hannity and Colmes, when it was Hannity and Colmes. And they started asking him some bizarre questions about teaching, you know, about AIDS awareness that Sesame Street was doing. And Kermit's, you know, has a connection to Sesame Street. And Kermit reacted with just, you know, a series of facial gestures that floored, you know, both Hannity and Colmes, and were absolutely the correct response.
Then again, Lewis admits that silence is best when it's intentional.
Jim Henson was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and he had Kermit, and Jim's not a ventriloquist. He just held Kermit in his hand, and when Kermit talked, you know, Jim's lips moved. It was no big deal. But during the first commercial break, the sound man, the boom mic, came over and said, I'm having trouble picking up the frog. Because every time Kermit talked, they moved the boom mic over the frog instead of keeping it over Jim. And that is absolutely how convincing people are convinced it is the frog talking. Even though Jim is sitting there, his lips are moving, you know it's him, but he's inside Kermit now.
That's not to say that words don't matter. It just seems that everyone who worked with Jim Henson was trained to pass, or at least share the buck. Now, I do notice something strange. When I was talking with the builders and talking to the performers, they always mentioned how integral and how important the writing was. Now I'm talking to the writer, and the writer's mentioning how important the performance was. Is it just that none of you guys can ever take any credit for anything?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. No, because I think we appreciate each other. And again, that goes back to, I believe it was Frank Oz who said that Jim had many gifts as an artist and as an entertainer and as a pioneer in television and all that. But Jim's greatest gift was he was an appreciator. He appreciated what the people around him. He didn't micromanage. He found people who shared a sensibility and who had a creative talent to give, and he let them loose.
And just to go back to the chicken and the egg question, what does come first, the foam or the quill?
The foam or the quill. Those are good character names. Character creation is a really good thing to talk about, because it is, talk about a situation that is, that really combines everyone's input. A writer can't create a character that a performer doesn't understand or believe, no matter how good. A builder can't build a character that is just a physical presence unless there's character behind that. And a performer can bring the character to life verbally and with an attitude and a certain understanding. It has to be this kind of perfect minuet of everybody, the physical inspiring, the writing inspiring, the performing, and all of it coming together to create a new existence. And sure, that's discovery. That's That's creativity at its best.
Sesame Street's Fran Brill agrees that the team needs to work together in seamless concert, but more, that it never tries to talk down or pander.
Yes, and nobody is gooey, icky, sweet. I think even Prairie Dawn, who was the first real, you know, female character who I did, they wanted her to be that way. But, you know, that's not particularly funny. And she would play the piano for all these guys, you know, in these pageants. But it just sort of slowly evolved that she actually, for being the smallest puppet, was the most secure of all of these puppets and, you know, a little bossy. And it became funny that she kind of held her own with all of these male puppets like Grover and Bert and Ernie. And she began to not only play the piano for them, but direct these pageants.
Why was music so important to the Muppets, whether on Sesame Street or The Muppet Show or any Muppet creation?
Jim was very musical himself and had a very good sense of music and what worked. And the music was always interesting. It wasn't, dippy children's music. And I don't mean to criticize other children's shows because I think there's a place for everybody. But the music was fabulous. I mean, we loved recording the music. It was intelligent music. I mean, Joe Raposa was a genius. And, we've gone through a few little stages over the many, many years of Sesame Street where the music got a little bit sappy and everybody realized it and said, no, you know, we don't really want to go. Let's not imitate what other people are doing. We're the gold standard here. Let's stick to what we do, which is interesting.
Yes, I love trash. Here's some more rotten stuff. I have here some newspaper, 13 months old. I've wrapped this inside and it's smelly and old. But I wouldn't trade it for a big pot of gold. I love it because it's trash. Yes, I love
Rubber Ducky, you're the one. You make bedtime lots of fun. Rubber Ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Vo-vo-vo-dee-o.
Now, what starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for Cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for Cookie, that's good enough for me. C is for Cookie, that's good enough for me. Oh, Cookie, Cookie, Cookie starts with C. Oh, C is for Cookie, that's good enough.
Can we switch gears for a moment? Can we talk about the shoes? I didn't realize that working with puppets was such a high fashion occupation. Just how high are those heels?
Well, that came about because I'm 5'4" and Jim Henson was about 6'3", and Frank Oz, if he isn't 6'3", is 6'2", and Jerry Nelson was rather tall. And I had to work alongside these guys when we were behind the Muppet wall. So how do we bring Fran up? Well, let's see, let's put her in boots, and they were boots at that time, you know, that zipped up to my knee. And they glued these platforms on. And I had to clump around in these crazy boots, and they were about 6 inches, I would say, which brought me up to their height or close to their height. And the big difficulty that I had to overcome was it was one thing to just stand there behind a wall, being a right hand or puppeteering Prairie Dawn or whatever, but we did a lot of these musical numbers to a tape recording of when we did a song, excuse me, if we were going to do a song, we had to listened to a playback that was played back on the floor. And we had these cables because the sound wasn't as developed as it was these days. And we were attached to these cables. And we had to run around doing choreography to these songs. And I just almost killed myself. I can't tell you how many times trying to keep up with either Jim, if I was right-handing for him, or doing my own character, because I had to run around just like they did, but I'm running around on these, high platform shoes. I guess you could say what Ginger Rogers used to say with Fred Astaire. She used to say, I do everything that Fred does, but in heels, and I did it backwards, but I had to do all this with these platforms. But then over the years, they sort of came up with a better design, so what I and the other gals wear now are flat, like sneakers, to which is glued a platform. So you're a little more stable than being in a boot.
Do you have to be in really good shape to work with the Muppets? What's it like holding this puppet over your head, wearing these gigantic boots for long stretches of time?
I don't think it's that exhausting. I think it's more a matter of coordination. I was really lucky. Because I came from the theater, I took dance my whole life. I still take dance. I will take dance till the day I die. You know, it's part of who I am. So I know where my body parts are, and I'm fairly agile. So that wasn't such an obstacle for me. The part of standing with your arm over your head, it's not recording that makes you tired. The time your arm really gets tired is when you are lip-syncing to a pre-recorded song and the song goes on and on and on, or when you're doing live television when you cannot bring your arm down. When we're shooting Sesame Street, the directors, the stage manager, they all know that, you know, our arms are up. So they'll, you know, if we have to redo a scene or a shot or something like that, you know, our arms come down. We aren't holding them forever and ever and ever above our head. But if you're doing live TV and you're doing an interview or something, you can't put your arm down. So that can be really, really painful. And there have been times when I had a puppet that was so heavy, because once you put a wig and a heavy costume, I'll give you an example. I'll tell a tale on myself. I did a character called the Countess, who was the love interest for the Count. And she had this very heavy blonde wig and a tiara and a very heavy velvet gown. And all that extra weight, and she's a live hand puppet too, made it really exhausting for me. I mean, I'm a small person to begin with, but all that weight was really tough to do a song in. And there was one point where I was doing a song with Jerry Nelson. Again, we're doing the choreography to a pre-record. And my hand started to cramp up. It wasn't the biceps, it was my hand, because we push the puppet's mouth when we puppeteer and to open and close it. And the top of my hand started to absolutely freeze up. And I tried to push through it and work through it and keep going, and I couldn't. And I had to stop, and Kevin Clash, who does Elmo, took over for me. And I was really embarrassed about it, but, you know, what could I do? I had a non-functioning hand at that point. That's the only time that's happened, but, you know, you just press on as best you can.
Now, I probably shouldn't admit this, but sometimes when I'm out in the field interviewing, if someone gives a really long answer, like for 5 or 10 minutes, my arm gets tired just holding out the mic, and that only weighs a pound or two.
Of course it does. Of course it does. There was one time when there was a whole bunch of us, and I don't know, it was a very difficult shot, and we were in extremely difficult positions because our job is to keep our arm up but our head out of the shot. And one of the puppeteers said to Jim, "Oh, Jim, this is killing me." You know, not complaining really, but kind of making a joke about it. And Jim said, "Hey, if it was easy, everybody would do this." And I think that's what you have to remember is, you know, this is just what comes along with a job.
Excuse me. You shouldn't talk about how heavy some of us Muppets are. Some of us have problems with our body image.
I have a very slow metabolism.
And when we're done performing,
They lock us in a drawer. We never get to exercise. My gym actually canceled my membership. The only time they let us out is for performances.
I have never been paid overtime.
Plus, some of us have big bones.
You have bones? I have rods.
Rods? I have bones and mechs.
Mechs? Why do you need a mechanic in your body? No wonder you're too heavy for Fran Brill to lift.
I think he meant mechanisms. Machines that help the puppeteer make his character move?
You mean like candy?
Maybe we should talk to Bonnie Erickson. She knows a lot about the technology behind Muppets.
The Bonnie Erickson? You mean the one that made Miss Piggy and the Philly Fanatic?
Yes. Bonnie worked closely with Jim Henson. She even knows how he started his career with puppets.
Jim was fascinated with television. His first love was actually the technology behind television, and he was interested in film as well. He saw an ad run by a local television show looking for a puppeteer for a small piece they wanted to do on television. And he went to the library, and he got a book on puppets, and he applied, and he got the job. So he didn't start out as a puppeteer. It just turned out that he was not only was a great comedian, but he also could see things from an audience's point of view. So he was able to translate that into something that was successful even at that early stage. If you look at some of his early commercials, they were very irreverent.
10, 9, 8, 7.
Hey, will Wilson certified Franks make me an astronaut too?
No, 6, 5, 4.
But they're all meat and full of muscle-building protein.
Look, you won't get anywhere by eating Wilson Franks. 3, 2, 1.
He was an innovator. He has a couple of patents for things that he did, and as you watch the work go through, he had Foz Fazakis, who was doing specialty remote control, really came into their own in Fraggle Rock with Doozers. Jim was always looking for the next way to do something, blue screen, green screen, all of that was part of the technique, and certainly as time was going on, he was going to be doing more and more of that. It was just part of his life. He was solving these problems and using the latest technology.
And was that what was really exciting to him? Was it solving the problem or was it telling the story?
I think they were a combination. If he could tell the story in a unique way, given the kinds of technology that was available, that's what he wanted to do. Before Jim, I believe there was no one doing television puppets the way he did. He dropped the proscenium. He used the camera and the frame of the television as his frame for the behavior. He also had the puppeteers looking at their own performance so they could react and see what they were doing and have feedback. It all helped move the story along, and it also influenced the way the puppets were built. They were built so that with very little movement, you could get a lot of expression. And that was also something that was not always something puppets did early on.
Not only did the technology behind the puppets change, many of the puppets themselves evolved over the years. Rolly Krusen has been building puppets for Henson and Sesame Street since the early 1970s, including some very ticklish favorites.
Elmo has changed. I started building him 18 or 19 years ago, and when he was first built, he was this little red monster is what he was called, that Carolee Wilcox originally built. And his fur was like kind of candy floss. It was really ugly, and you could see the backing. And over the years, his shape hasn't changed so much. Oh, he's got in his arms are little round wooden beads on a nylon line, so that he really has no elbows. He's just got great loopy arms. And originally, these little wooden beads had little oriental heads drawn on them. So I keep using them. If one wears out, I'll take those beads and still use them. So 18 years later, there's still a few of those beads floating around that have the little oriental heads painted on them.
Rolly says that ideas for how to make a puppet better can come from anywhere. After all, the puppet builders are one giant family.
My daughter helped me. She was 4 when Zoe was built, and she decided that Zoe needed sparkles in her hair. So, I mean, that occurred, you know, because of my daughter. And then Fran wanted more hair, so she's gotten more hair over the years. And her basic shape hasn't changed. But, you know, we add things and take things away if they don't work for the performers.
Of course, even the best of families can be beset by bouts of grumpitude. Hecklers, critics, grouches, and sourpusses invade to add their 2 cents all too frequently. But no one really minds. In fact, Bonnie Erickson designed some of the most famous grumps in the Muppet universe.
The two old men are probably a couple of my real favorites, because not only did I like doing their facial expressions and the way they function, but I also love the anatomy underneath those funny suits. I love the way it was very satisfying to me. And I think as a builder, as a designer and builder, the shapes are really important and how they move. And, you know, you can make dolls, you can make all kinds of things that are sculpts. But the thing that appealed to me about sculpture for puppets is they moved. And you had to think about that as you were building it. And I do have a story about the two old men. They took a great deal of time to carve. They were all done by scissoring first, getting the shape, and then that left them with the texture, and you had to do noses separately, ears separately, attach them to the puppet. But the final step was always sanding them on a belt sander. And you had to hold this foam up to the belt sander and sort of sculpt on the machine. And if you lost your concentration for even 1 second, it went right through the sander. And that's what happened to me. I was almost finished with Statler. And I just saw one little thing that I wanted to smooth out. I went upstairs to the tool room, and I got the sander going. And I started sanding the head, and I lost it for just a second. And the head ended up in the other side of the room with a hole all the way through the middle. And I had to start all over again.
And did you guys have a clue what you were doing? Did you realize that you were creating figures that probably are going to become, if they haven't already become, part of the cultural mythology of the United States?
If we had realized that, I wouldn't be looking through bags of dust with some of the puppets that are remaining. No, we built them strictly for the moment. Jim wanted them for a performance piece, and when you look at Jim's work, it is the videos, it is the film. The artwork that went into the characters was beautiful. If you look at some of the detail, which he encouraged, it's extraordinary what kinds of detail we were allowed to put into these things. Did we know that they were, we didn't build them to last forever, but did we know they would last forever? I think we all felt we were contributing to something pretty special.
Do you know the story of the Roadrunner?
No, I don't.
Okay. In the late 1940s, early 1950s, and don't quote me on the date,
okay.
Warner Brothers had made 2 or 3 Roadrunner shorts, and they thought they were flops. They thought they were really horrible, just not well received by the public. And then they started getting these stories that Air Force jets would pass one another in the air, and the pilots would radio over to each other, meep, meep. And that's when they said, we have a hit, and they began creating it. So did you ever have a character that you were like, well, it'll work for this scene, and then we'll move on? And then it turned out that character had amazing resonance and became a star.
Well, I would never tell her that, but Miss Piggy is sort of like that. She was one of the 3 pigs Jim asked me to do for this Pigs in Space number, or it was called Return to the Planet of the Pigs, and we did it for one of the specials. And she really had hooves for hands, and she had little small button eyes to start with. And then there was a Herb Alpert show that came up, and very quickly we had to make her a really glamorous pig. So I went to the eye drawer, changed her eyes, long eyelashes, gave her a long blonde wig, threw a dress together out of some satin that we had, and I made gloves because I didn't have time to make real hands, and it just stuck. So she wore that costume, but she also, if you look at early shows of The Muppet Show, she's in the chorus line. She's doing a number of roles as a very different pig. But I'm always saying she knew she was going to be famous. And when Frank Oz started the karate chop, I think that the rest is history.
How much do characters change and how much are you afraid to change them because of the way they're identified by the public?
I don't think Jim was ever afraid to change anything. If it works, use it was sort of the byword. The first Oscar was orange and he was changed to green. Nobody really remembers, I think, that he was orange at one time. And the pig became sort of a chorus girl personality. All of a sudden she became a real glamour puss. The technology for how she was built changed. The personality evolved and all of that worked together and there was no problem. That was a very sort of slow evolution that made sense.
Mind you, some of the most clever invention was not necessarily done for the shows or movies.
We always had something going on. We had mice that learned to eat all the buildings that we created. We had rubber bands that would stretch all around the room so the next person to open the door would be surprised. There were all Don would go up on the ceiling or up on the roof of the building and drop down a puppet. So it was looking in the window when somebody came in and didn't expect it.
And as the creator of these guys, do you find yourself being protective and possessive?
I used to be. I've gotten over that. I think you have to. But I think it's important to do it when you first start out so that you set things off in the right way. We were originally hired, for instance, with the Phillies to do a program that was they wanted a mascot. I was thinking a whole program, which meant supportive materials, merchandising, a whole community outreach program, which they were very involved in. And you want to set them off on the right foot. And Jim gave me the kind of training for that. He paid attention to those details. And so I think the success had to do with the fact that the team paid attention to that as well. You want to be a little protective at the start, and then you have to learn to let them have a life of their own.
The builders aren't the only one who feel the weight of responsibility. Actress Fran Brill understands the burden of keeping the characters vibrant and authentic for parents who return to the show and for the children who discover Sesame Street for the first time. More, she feels a special need to get it right when voicing characters like Cammy, a South African who's HIV positive.
Yeah, I feel particularly responsible with Cammy, the South African puppet, in that, first of all, I did not originate her. She is being performed on the South African production called Takalani Sesame by a bona fide black South African. What I have tried to do is replicate somewhat what she does, and I had to, you know, learn the accent and everything. And now she's, I don't know whether I guess I have my own version of her. And again, I only do her in the United States and, you know, at the UN and stuff like that. This other puppeteer does do her in South Africa. But I feel enormous responsibility when I do her because I think that this is such an important character and I love doing her. And, you know, I want her to be a real little five-year-old girl. However, often she has to say things that a five-year-old is probably a little too immature to say. I mean, sometimes I will rewrite the script so it sounds a little bit more like a five-year-old. But I love doing this because it's such a wonderful thing to give a face to a child who has HIV and is, you know, ignored and made fun of, and, you know, to raise the consciousness of people all over the world that you can't treat anyone that way, let alone somebody with HIV. And it's educational, you know, teaching people that you don't catch it by kissing them or whatever. As far as Zoe goes, I love her. I don't know if she's my daughter, my child, or what. You know, she obviously has to be some part of me, but I love doing her and seeing how she handles the lines that she has to say. I feel like I'm the conduit here. I feel like I channel her, but she isn't really me, but I just feel a responsibility of her being true to who she is. I'll tell you one thing that I find interesting about her. she is very popular with people and children who have autism or Asperger's. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, I'm going to guess that a lot of the puppets are, but I can't tell you how much mail I get from parents of autistic children. And I even had a child come, who the father of whom contacted me and came to the set. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but I have found that very interesting.
And I was told you brought a friend along for your interview here on Cobblestones. Is Zoe around?
Let me call her and see if I can find her. Zoe? Zoe? Somebody wants to talk to you. Hello?
Hi, Zoe.
Who's this?
My name is Andrew, and I've come from Washington, D.C., all the way down the cobblestone path to Sesame Street to talk with you.
Oh, hi. Hi. Where's Washington?
Well, Washington's on the east coast of the United States, and it's where the president lives. It's the capital of our country.
Oh, the president? Cool. You know, his wife came to Sesame Street. Mrs. I forgot her name, but it's Mama or Amaba, something like that. She was really nice.
Wow. You get to meet so many special people on Sesame Street. Actors, politicians, musicians, writers. Do you ever get intimidated?
I don't know what that means. That was a big word.
Oh, intimidated means feeling kind of shy. Do you ever feel shy around some of these important people or even the kids you get to meet?
I don't think so. I'm just me and they're just who they are. They're just people. I don't think so. Everybody's always nice when they come visit us on Sesame Street. They're always really happy to be there. Because we have fun. We all get along and we work and play and learn things together. Do you know the alphabet?
Yes, I think so.
What's the first word? The first letter of the alphabet?
The first letter is A.
Yeah, that's right. And what's the last letter of the alphabet?
Well, the first letter is A, like in my name, Andrew. And the last letter is Z, as in Zoe.
Z for Zoe. You got it. But I think I have to go now. I think Big Bird needs me.
Okay. Thank you so much for chatting with me, Zoe. I'll see you later.
Okay. Bye.
This cobblestone path wends its way from Washington, D.C. through Manhattan on its way to Los Angeles before culminating at Dave Gohl's home in Northern California. It couldn't have been done without the help of many. Our thanks go out to Arthur Novell, Bonnie Erickson, Ellen Lewis, David First, with production assistance from Jonathan Cherry, Toby Schreiner, Alicia Hiller-Mamadov, Eric Brooks, and of course a special thank you to Dave Gohls, Jim Lewis, Fran Brill, and Roly Crewson, who lent their talent, as well as their time. Thank you for helping us place one more stone along the path. For Cobblestones, I'm Andrew Hiller.